you know, the lessons from the financial crisis, let alone the lessons from Japan from 1990s and 2000s, have not really been learned and they haven't been encapsulated in institutional frameworks. And the key lesson I focus on is that, you know, this sort of artificial separation of monetary and fiscal policy, and then essentially assigning the responsibility for macro demand management to the central bank, to technocrats, was a particular solution, institutional solution to problems of overheating, overspending, the fact that governments may have used the privilege of having access to the printing press, etc. So the response to the high inflations or hyperinflations of the 20th century. But that by design is actually very ill-suited to the kind of conditions that Japan suffered in the 1990s and then the world experienced the Great Recession. But it's sort of a little bit sort of staggering to me that while people moan and groan about central banks being the only game in town, and top of the list central bankers themselves, nobody other than maybe there's some thinking going on in the MMT community, sort of new to this kind of venue, but there's very little original imaginative thinking about, okay, what are we going to do about it? And I would, for one, would argue that, much closer alignment and coordination between what we call monetary and fiscal policy would be a good place to start. But I don't see a lot of evidence that's happening. But I think the seeds of that are being planted. So I think, as the Fed normalizes monetary policy to support that term, the obsession will go on. And the obsession of watching what Mario Draghi has for breakfast will go on.
What color ties?
But I think the seeds are being planted at the moment, at least my hypothesis, my gut is telling me, all of this talk about, what are we going to do in the next downturn? Because a lot of these central banks won't have much monetary policy ammunition. And then there's this idea that then we don't have fiscal policy ammunition as well. In other words, you back yourself into this nihilistic corner that we won't actually in the next recession, particularly for the Eurozone or Japan, but even the US, have very much macroeconomic policy ammunition, fiscal space, monetary space, to get the economy back to full employment and price stability. And if you believe that, well, first of all, why would you believe that? And secondly, it's wrong to believe that, and you end up in a very nihilistic kind of place. So I suspect that, this MMT ideas are going to have a sort of second coming in the next downturn. It was striking just on the last point. A couple of years back, again, as a market participant, very striking. We had a little period of a couple of months where helicopter money was being seriously debated. And I was actually on a trip to Europe, and I came back and I wrote a piece straight away because I'd been at a couple of central banks in the Euro system where very senior people were raising the issue in conversations about helicopter money. And 2 days in a row, I looked at the German newspaper, not that I can read German, but my colleague pointed out to me, look, there's a headline here about helicopter money. So, I think we're sort of, the obsession will continue until it proves to be very, very self-defeating, and I think something else might happen at that point in time.
I'll just quickly say, I think in a lot of these cases, looking to what's happening in Japan and the Bank of Japan's actions are always like an interesting role of light in terms of the path forward. They've been doing some form of this for a long time. In the 1930s, they engaged in this process of monetizing some of their fiscal spending to help ward off the worst effects of the Great Recession. But at some point, I think it would be very interesting if the Bank of Japan decided to actually just cancel some of the JGBs on its balance sheet, and then people would say, oh my god, there's an impact to the Bank of Japan. And then people would say, so what? And until you have like those sort of kind of classic types of things, it's very hard for people to talk to that because no one wants to say it first, right? Until someone actually does it, and then you can point to it. And so to me, Japan is has been one of the big monetary experiments that people just like to forget about when they talk about the United States. Like it doesn't exist, this massive market with this enormous operation. Well, that's just over there. It's strange.
Can I just second that? Because I spent a lot of time in Japan. You're absolutely right, Amar. on all of these issues with quantitative easing, zero interest rate policy, not negative interest rates, credit easing, macroprudential policy, going back to the 30s, they sort of got to Keynesian economics almost before Keynes. And now, of course, you know, they've gone with QQE with yield curve control and negative interest rates. So they've got, you know, monetary policy in Japan is 2 points on the yield curve. The overnight rate is minus 10 basis points, but very cleverly, only for the marginal amount of reserves that have been created by the QQE. They've committed, and then they're pegging the 10-year rate at around zero, which now is plus or minus 20 basis points. Just pretty incredible stuff. And then you've got still a commitment to continue to expand the balance sheet until they overshoot on 2% inflation. And I think this is a really, they don't talk about this very much, really, really interesting in my view, because it sort of essentially sets up this this sort of mousetrap where they're saying, I interpret it, and this is the way I interpret it, to say, the Bank of Japan is betting that, or you might say the consolidated government in Japan is betting that either they'll be able to continue, they'll be able to kill deflation and achieve 2% inflation by refinancing JGBs back into central bank reserves without limit, or if they proves the case they're not able ever to achieve 2% inflation, the consolation prize is there will be no government debt left in existence that is capable of defaulting. So why this obsession with the looming fiscal crisis? It's actually, you know, logically pretty much impossible. Now, what you will do is basically kind of destroy the bond market, but that's another issue.
Should we take some audience questions?
We haven't talked about the equity market very much, and I wonder how you think MMT might support things. I had this nightmare of where the balanced budget, the deficit talks and the balanced budget people might get within power and start to reduce the deficit and put that in very deflationary, and would that tip over the hurt the stock market a lot? So, and which involves American savings. And so do you see any relationship between fiscal policy and MMT and stock
market? Just a quick, I think there's actually zero chance of that ever happening. I don't mean to be flip or to be belittling that. If anything, I'm belittling the austerians. It seems never to have happened yet in this country that people professing austerity come to power and practiced it. And for that, I thank God. I thank God that they talk austerity and don't actually do austerity. I also do think that we probably are headed for more turbulence ahead. And my guess is that when that happens, you know, just as Bernanke said, when we're atheists and philosophers and austerians in crisis, I think there's even more reason to suppose that the austerians won't be listened to or be doing anything other than making sure that all of the continuing spending is being spent on the wrong things instead of the right things.
Well, I mean, for my 2 years covering equity markets, people did say that valuations were inflated somewhat by low interest rates, which would follow to say that higher interest rates or tighter policy would suppress valuations. And the funny thing is, Americans really like when the stock market goes up. So that, you know, in itself is sort of a built-in market.
Yes, I'd like to go way back to basics and actually follow up, say again, question that I asked in this room at the end of the last session. And that is that it's widely believed and widely said in some of the most sophisticated circles, and I think Paul Krugman would be an example of this and others, that if we can, although he doesn't do well, he does such great columns and all that. But on this point, it is that continuing large deficits are bound to increase interest rates, and higher interest rates will freeze out private investment because people who are going to expand their little deli over here on 6th Avenue will see that interest rates are going up to 6 or 7%. And not do that expansion they were thinking of doing when it was only 3%. That is very, very widely believed now. And maybe I'll just leave it at that. could you, and I, let me just say that this, what am I, disabusing the world of that concept is one of the most fundamental things that MMT can do. Unwinding this notion that the interest rates are really the loanable funds idea, that there's a limited amount of loanable money, and that if the government takes too much of it, there won't be enough for the private sector, and national economic growth will slow, and our children will lead poorer lives than they would if we run these big deficits. That is almost universal that said in the beginning.
Yeah, once again, I think the two good reasons that I don't think that's going to happen. The first is that Paul Krugman says it will. and the second is that we're still struggling to meet the inflation target. Right? I mean, I think it's a much more reasonable scenario to imagine us going the route of Japan than going the route of whatever fantasy example from history Paul Krugman seems to have in his head.
Yeah, I think that sort of crowding out argument against government spending, you know, is a very kind of old-fashioned, you know, kind of almost anachronistic kind of argument debate. I mean, first of all, I like to think about all these things always in my own sort of mind, sort of toggling between the financial and monetary economy and the real economy. And, you know, talking about crowding out just purely in sort of financial economy or monetary terms somehow misses point that the crowding out is really going to be in the real economy with real resources. And I think this point was observed by somebody yesterday, that that's, you know, at the end of the day, there are finite resources. You can only increase them through, you know, innovation and real potential growth increases. So you've got, you know, at some point you're going to hopefully kind of hit your speed limit for the overall utilization of resources, and there's scarcity of resources and there's crowding out in that sense. But to focus too much on the financial side, I think, is a little bit get sent to a blind alley, particularly given the debate in the last few years has been very much around, you know, secular stagnation. I don't like that term. It just doesn't give, you know, it's not a very insightful term, but secular stagnation debate, as many people I'm sure in this room know, is this hypothesis that for some reason or other, the so-called natural rate of interest or the real rate of interest that's associated with full employment and price stability, you know, is very, very low and is set to stay low for an awful long time. So if that's the world we're in, which is debatable, you know, crowding out is kind of the last thing you should be worried about.
I've heard a quick, just one quick point for the
I actually think the bigger risk is more that the private sector or the, you know, real economy doesn't have enough safe assets. I mean, I think that was a pretty big topic of discussion. I mean, what precipitated the financial crisis in the first place, but a lot of private sector assets that were billed as safe, all of a sudden were not safe. So, you know, and you're even seeing that again. I mean, people are talking about CLOs, which is collateralized obligations, which are a bunch of high yields, like leveraged junk loans, that are being repackaged and sold to banks, sometimes in Japan, I'm hearing, as safe AAA-rated assets. So I don't think there's enough.
Yeah, so two follow-ups. First is just to introduce the inequality problem in here, because I think it's opposite here. I think one reason that secular stagnation stories look more realistic now than they used to look is precisely because of the unbelievably widely sort of skewed distribution of wealth and income in this country and many other developed countries. And of course, as we know, right, as wealth sort of accumulates up the top of the distribution, spending power, effective demand is sort of sucked out of the economy. And so for as long as wages are repressed or suppressed, and as long as salaries are suppressed, as long as the great mass of Americans and other people in the developed world don't have that much spending power, the challenge is going to be the Japan-type challenge, not the crowding out challenge. Second, by looking at state assets, it's worth noting that I think Alex is exactly right. One of the arguments that's often made as to why there were so many bad MBS out there that got triple A ratings was because the market really needed them. It's a bit like Voltaire's conception of God, right? If God didn't exist, we would have to be invented. If safe assets don't exist, they have to be invented. And this isn't only true in the sense that people need the safe assets in order to help have something safe in their portfolios. Note that even the actual pricing models on which all market activity is based and predicated, right? The CAPM, Steve Ross's arbitrage pricing model, all of the models on which everybody depends in order to engage in rational trading behavior of any kind at all, each model of this sort posits one hypothetical risk-free asset in relation to which all of the others are valued. And so it actually is necessary to invent a safe asset if it doesn't exist, because the pricing model on which you act in the markets themselves itself depends on their existence. So you've got to find something that you can call safe. And so for there to be trading at all, you're going to have all sorts of sovereign debt out there, especially US debt. One final historical point in this connection, I think it's not an accident that every single major capital market in the world, from the New York Stock Exchange to London to Frankfurt to the Italian exchanges to the Tokyo Exchange, every single one of these originated as an emporium in which government sovereign debt was sold. And only after that was established did private companies find that, oh, there's a focal point, there's a marketplace where we can float our own debt instruments now too, or our own equities too. But every single one of these markets began as a place at which sovereign debt was sold. That's not an accident.
Charles, I'm basically retired. Just a comment, not a question, but mainstream economists, I've had considerable contact with mainstream economists. The number of them do understand, those that understand that macro economic money, and they're more up there in terms of understanding. They still get stuck on the crowning edge of that myth. And so that's worth working on. So that was not my question. Let's go back to Joe's first question. Are there things out there in the marketplace today that are not fully discounted, that insights from MMT, you know, as an investor or whatever? My comment there was hesitant to comment on is that part of it's already in the market, but profits have been very strong. And we know from MMT, we're good at collecting and others are loving and so on, that budget government deficits feed into corporate profits, not dollar for dollar, but plus. And it has been one of the reasons for people ask why the stock market has been strong. Well, profits have been strong, and that's why profits have been strong. Deficit has gone up. There are other factors as well. People are spending more money relative to their income. But to the question going forward, we all know about the quote entitlement crisis. Well, guess what? The entitlement crisis, everyone's raising their hands because deficits are going to be $1 trillion deficits forever, I read about. And guess what? If you're an investor, you know, these professionals that you've been talking about, they're raising their hands. In reality, that is going to be a reason why profits are going to remain relatively strong, if that be so-called elevated valuations we have right now. Maybe maintain until the next recession, maybe still years away. So that would be the insight I would like.
Hello. I think there probably is an entitlement crisis. I think it's that there's not enough entitlement.
Hi, I'm Sanjeev. I previous life was a bond trader. I'll start with a compliment, a comment, and then I'll try to respond to Joe's. One of Joe's questions. Bob, I loved your analogy between legal and the MMT. It was very insightful. Two, I was a little disappointed with all this talk about reserve currency. I know there are pros and cons, but MMT works as long as you've got a fiat currency. You know, we don't talk about what happened to the pound after it lost the reserve currency status. So I was a little disappointed to see that, because, at least in my mind, the reserve currency, nothing in MMT fails because you're not a reserve currency.
Sanjeev, I just want to comment to that. People do talk about what happened to England after the pound lost its reserve currency. The quality of life was not particularly good. Like, there was still a heavy importing nation at the time. And the ability to use the pound like they had in prior decades, like, led to the rationing of real goods and services, real goods, at least for individuals. So, now we are talking about it. There was a not so great period following the war, that didn't exist in the U.S.
And it's because the sort of the locus of the fiat, right, only has jurisdiction over its own territory, right? So I think that's the key point. I mean, I don't think anybody would say that loss of reserve currency status means you don't still have monetary sovereignty within the jurisdiction of your own nation. The only reason I think reserve currency status is relevant at all ever is that if a nation is to enjoy something analogous to that sort of monetary sovereignty that it has domestically, even outside of its own borders, that only works if it's a kind global sovereign or quasi-global sovereign in addition to being a domestic sovereign. And the UK kind of had that status, right, until the end of the Second World War. And it's no accident, of course, that that's one of the problems, the internal adjustment difficulties, you might say.
Let's take that up offline.
I exercise rapid privilege to ask a quick follow-up question on that, which is one of the things that I understand that MT emphasizes strongly in regards to the kind of dealing with people a little bit earlier is that Treasury, in most countries, central banks are prohibited from intervening directly in the primary dealer in primary auctions. I know Joshua Ann Collins has a paper leading institute looking at Canada actually doing it significantly for a period of decades of being in primary auction, like up to the about 30%, 40% of the issue on a regular basis. But in a world where most of the banks are prohibited from direct primary auction intervention, they continue to do it on the back end in the way that anybody who stands in the middle of that stance may essentially risk the arbitrage profit. Now, my question there is, do you have to actually stay in that currency, stay in that country's assets to benefit from that risk-free arbitrage? Is it possible that there could be global demand for the US dollar as long as there's a risk-free arbitrage profit to be made by participating in that initial bond market, knowing the Fed is going to stand in on the back end, buy that up from you, and then you simply take that arbitrage profit back out of the US dollar to forex swaps or something?
I mean, I was
going to
say that, and this is something you were saying at lunch, when I was at lunch at some meetings, is that people have gone bankrupt trading the Treasury, right? Like, it's not like, it's risk-free in the sense you'll get all of your money back, you get all of your dollars back, but the framework which all these participants operate under is a mark-to-market consideration. And oftentimes, that's, if they're not natural holders of dollars, they have to finance them. And then, so, you know, that could be problematic. And I think, you know, when you go to these big dealer desks and the banks, each of those desks are operating like as their own sort of profit center, as how they, you know, when they finance their positions and when they buy bonds. So if I don't see a trader saying, I know the Fed's going to backstop this at a certain point to help me out. So in a way, I think you're right, but if financial conditions got crazy in treasury markets, there is this backstop, theoretically. But everyone involved in that, up to that point, probably is traders. Like, that's the operation, you know, that's the assumption that might work.
I want you, you're going to answer my question, then I want to go over here.
So, a couple of places where I think the market hasn't discounted. So, the one is related to what some of your panels thought. You know, in Japan is different, right? And they'll tell you things like demographics, the trading situation. And I think, look, it's the best experimental economic scenario that we can learn from. And so I do agree with you. I think we've got, you know, when you've got debt to GDP at 100% opposed to, and up to 200%, it limits politically how much you can raise rates, right? So you get the bond marginalities in and predict 6% rates, I'm buying that, right? So that's one place. The other place where I think I haven't seen a lot of work on this is always think of MMT as single countries not interacting with each other. And so I think there's some money to be made in the currency markets if you follow the flows, right? I remember Warren telling me, I guess it was about a year and a half ago, he said, you know, we're going to reach the bottom of the euro soon. And he was basing it on flows because the Swiss central bank was buying US treasuries and people were moving euros to Switzerland. So I think that's one place where I haven't seen a lot of good work, but I think it's very important.
Question?
So, I just like to maybe ask you to examine MMT from the role of savers. Like, let's say we've gone kind of full MMT, as to say, you know, we promised to peg the policy rate at zero, and there's a full jobs guarantee. What do you think the implications are in terms of, you know, corporate profitability and, say, you know, private insurance companies, private pensions, you know, and who have generally locked in safe rates at a, you know, positive, at least nominal return, and the credit risk involved? Is this kind of a backdoor need to socialize more of those insurance and pensions? Is that, you know, implicitly embedded in this?
Yeah, I mean, big question. I think in those kind of questions, I think context really matters. So just sort of coming at this issue in terms of saying, well, what would happen if you had zero interest rate effect for a long time and this and that? I think you're, it's a little bit like saying, you know, what's going to happen when the central bank does QE? Well, if the central bank, context matters. If the central bank is doing QE, you know, at full employment and inflation is going through the roof, you know, you're going to be able to buy it. So what are the circumstances that sort of call for the situation that you just posited, and sort of start there and work from there? And yes, I mean, at the end of the day, had the entitlement kind of issue came up before, and the same thing comes up with pension funds and lower rates of return, etc. You know, society collectively can only make promises to itself that will, or credible promises, or promises that will not be defaulted on, you know, if they can actually be met in the future. So I come back again with this entitlements debate, with the issue about the poor old savers not getting any interest on their principal, but at least they're getting their principal, and presumably the reason for the low interest rates is that the assets that are ultimately out there, which the principal is a claim on, are probably not going to get their principal back. So yeah, you take the cut on the savings and returns for a while to preserve your principal till you dig yourself out of the hole. So that's sort of the way I approach it.
I'll just add something really quick to that on the fiscal side. I mean, I'm probably over-sanguine. I might be over-sanguine about this, and I'm usually accused of that more often than I'm accused of being under-sanguine. But I think if we actually adopted a full-on JG, the macroeconomic effect would be so enormous that I think profitability would way up through the roof for many companies, right? I'm convinced that there's just so much slack, there's so much human capacity underutilization still underway, precisely because all the wealth is at the top of the distribution, precisely because real incomes, salaries, and the like are still where they were in the mid-1970s. I think that the boost to aggregate demand that would come from the foreign JG, not just in the form of employing more people, but also changing the benchmark wage rate, and thus raising wages and salaries for the first time in real terms for some 30 or 40 years, I think it would just be enormous. If it with which would probably see China for a while until things have kind of normalized to the new normal.
Could I just add to that the participation rate as well has not come up with a rational rate.
When it comes to the savers question, I think that it's interesting to look at the accounting policy around that, because if you look, actually, corporate pensions are becoming extremely well-funded because they changed the law about the way they account for them. And so now all they're doing is they're investing in securities called strips, which means they don't care about interest. They just want a payment on date. And you don't need an interest rate above zero for that. So it could be pretty easily solved.
Definitely.
I just wanted to get you on the record to say something about inflation expectations. Since this is something that economists and central bankers are obsessed with, right? And letting us know that expectations are well anchored. Well, how do you think about that? And how do you unanchor inflation expectations? What's the scenario that gives rise to inflation expectations becoming unanchored? And then what would be the consequences? Or do they even matter the way we tend to think?
Stephanie was seen looking at me there, so let me go first. I think the fixation with inflation expectations is, you know, sort of corollary of the whole, you know, kind of obsession with central banks being the only game in town, etc. And you know, within that conventional, the macroeconomic policy framework as we have it today, the role of inflation expectations is absolutely critical. With central, again, everybody in this room probably knows all the stuff backwards, but you know, it is the dirty little secret of the inflation targeting regime is that central banks target inflation. Well, they target inflation by anchoring or managing or controlling somehow the public's inflation expectations. If they can do that, if that means essentially inflation becomes a self-fulfilling phenomenon, which makes it much easier. So how do they actually manages inflation expectations in public by announcing inflation target and convincing the public that they have both the tools, the ability, and the determination to use those tools to achieve the inflation target, that sort of anchors inflation expectations. And then you have this problem of, well, okay, that only has to work in two directions. One is sort of when the problem, the threat to price stability or the threat to, inflation expectations becoming unanchored is on the upside. Volcker kind of showed how to solve that problem at considerable cost. The problem then becomes on the downside. How do you do it when there's a zero bound? Well, that gets into the world of QE. And I think one thing that can be said sort of in defense of QE just in a conventional framework is that it restores the symmetry to the toolkit of the central bank, where in order, I think of this inflation targeting stuff, Stephanie, I like to bring a sort of a game theory framework, which is basically to say the central bank has to have a credible commitment, a credible threat to either create inflation or counter deflation. But that to do that, they have to have a tool that they can use on an unlimited basis. So QE essentially can expand the balance sheet forever. That gives you the same symmetry as being able to hike interest rates forever. But so that's sort of how I understand inflation expectations. But I think that another sort of when you think about it in those terms, it is a little bit of the Wizard of Oz kind of, wow, is that what it's all about? That's where the power of these central banks comes from. And it sort of diverts your attention away from all of the MMT stuff, which is in some ways more interesting, this esoteric kind of inflation expectation management thing. But I'm sort of reminded of, not that I went to Jackson Hole like you, get the invitation. But, was it 2 years ago or 3 years ago, maybe two, where the topic of Jackson Hole was trying to understand inflation dynamics. So that's, again, it's sort of like the bit of the secret is central bankers themselves use this paradigm and have the whole language and narrative and rhetoric and choreography, but they don't really necessarily understand where these inflation expectations really come from and what allows them particularly to be
it's
still, a bit of a black box.
So I was just going to say one thing, which I actually disagree a little bit, which is that it's not symmetric, right? It doesn't appear to be symmetric. And the curve tells us it's not symmetric. Mm-hmm. The curve or history has told us that the Federal Reserve knows how to fight inflation. It can kill the economy, and it can do a pretty good job of doing that. But creating inflation has been an extraordinary challenge. Under the frameworks that's been used. In Japan, they bought 40% of the government bond market, and it's amazing that they have upticks in inflation, right? It's celebrated. And so to me, the toolkit is actually not a very equal toolkit. They know how to prevent inflationary scenarios, so your upside inflation expectations remain, relatively effective. You don't think it's going to go crazy for unless there's something exogenous, but the deflationary aspect, that is something that I feel like no one seems to have a very good handle on from a monetary policy perspective. Again, considering Japan, they've not just changed because they bought ETFs. At some point, I'm not sure any financial assets, but I don't quite see the symmetry. And strangely enough, I always wish the Fed talks about symmetry, but it doesn't really seem to emphasize the fact that they're better on one way than they are on the other.
Stephen, can I come back? Sorry, just on that point. Sorry, just very quickly. No, I think you're kind of right on that point, to 80% there. And I use the analogy of sort of the hiking interest rates to control high inflation is sort of like a galloping galloping horse, and the Fed is sort of trying to pull it in, the central bank. Whereas trying to get inflation, whether in deflation, is a bit like whipping this mule, which is confused.
I think there's a very good reason for the eccentric, and again, I want to bring back the inequality thing again. And I think, in effect, what we're still going through is a kind of low-grade Fisher-style debt deflation. Private debt aggregates are, of course, through the roof everywhere other than mortgage debt. That continues to operate as a long-term drag on aggregate demand. And in order, I think, for inflationary expectations to be formulated and to be maintained, there has to be some reasonability to those expectations, right? We lawyers always distinguish between expectations on the one hand and reasonable expectations on the other. I think most people are relatively reasonable, and that's to say most people who have expectations have reasonable expectations. And I think most people kind of sense, even at the backs of their minds, even if they can't articulate fully why, that it would not be reasonable in the present environment to expect inflation, precisely because we've got this ongoing, very low labor force participation rate. We've got continuing growth in all private debt aggregates other than mortgage debt. And so you have a long-term deficit of aggregate demand in the economy. So there simply is no reason to expect inflation, and thus people aren't going to. And you can only jawbone so long in the face of a reality that's recalcitrant in that, in the way that this reality is. So I think that's the source of these imagery. I think it's a very profound imagery. It's also an ironic one, because people used to talk about how there's an inflationary bias built in to central bank policy, because everybody likes the free spending and people sort of object to the belt tightening. But I think there's anything a strong deflationary bias in expectations these days, precisely because people don't put back to their minds that there is this ongoing inequality problem and this growing rate of debt problem.
Stephanie, didn't you write an LA Times thing about what would happen if the government tried to buy a pony? Is that
a pony?
A pony. Well, I was thinking, like, if you really wanted to generate inflation, you could just have a policy of buying everyone a boat, and it would create so many shortages in every aspect of the economy, so many disruptions, so much uncertainty about what kind of resources are available. I think that would do it. So if we really have some thirst for higher inflation, I do think that would be a pretty good approach.
Thank you. Just one comment on that. Two things. One is the market monetarists, which there were a lot of disagreement back before they sort of became less relevant again. If you speak to people like David Beckwith and things, when they actually get to the point, they say, well, we have to stimulate by buying stuff from the central bank. We'll buy up all financial assets and there's still no inflation. We'll start buying real stuff.
Yeah.
At that point, they're just doing fiscal policy by the back end anyway without some legislative oversight or any, you know, distributional conversation with anybody other than the central bankers. The other question I want to raise is, we're all talking here as a raising rates, always contractionary. I'm thinking about situations where higher interest rates result in higher interest income, but only a marginal increase in the cost of lending. So somewhere like Japan, deflationary, so just as an example. So from my point of view, from the energy point that I understand, interest rate increases have at best a mixed outcome, even if they can be mostly expansionary. And then on that as well, if it is likely to be contractionary, it's usually not going to be this economic theory increase in the marginal cost of credit or something. It's more likely to be increasing the cost of debt refinancing in a way that, you know, guts homeowners or really kind of hurts real businesses and things, rather than sort of changing the marginal fine tuning of the amount of new business loans being created. So what everyone's thoughts on that?
I think that's a
really important point. I think it's the refi cost rate increases, I think, is much more important at this point than the sort of the more kind of common textbook story, again, since 2008 at least.
So I actually think that with the way the economy is developing, I mean, a smaller number of companies are employing a larger number of people. That's the inequality story of the corporate, and those companies are the ones that have to refinance their debt. So those are the ones that are going to be spending more, who are going to, you know, for them, they are making decisions based on this stuff, so I think that might be one way it's contractionary.
On this whole debate about, you know, how do you get out of deflation or how do you get the inflation rate up, and I sort of put the sort of, well, you could raise the interest rate or increase returns to savers in the same sort of bucket. First of all, I haven't seen a good real kind of explanation of how that's going to work. Generally, equilibrium, some people benefit, others won't. But more to the point, I think that where I come down on all these discussions is, the big lesson is, if you're in this hole, lack of aggregate demand, you've got the inequality issue, you deal with that sort of on the fiscal side. But I really think you've got to get out of this sort of, there's monetary policy here, there's fiscal policy there. And it's a little bit like this debate that you have in the central banking community. Well, gee, how do we get more ammunition? Let's raise the inflation target. Well, let's switch to price level target, the normal GDP target. They're all kind of like second order responses to, the first order problem is that you're not using monetary and fiscal policy together to get to the right place.
Question.
So the current administration is kind of conducting a very interesting experiment for us. So from a sectoral balances perspective, the budget deficit is growing quite rapidly. The current account deficit looks to be like kind of stable. I looked at the numbers, the lagging indicator, but, you know, it's stable. So that means, you know, by identity, the public sector or the private sector has quite a big surplus. And given what you're saying about debt deflation, like what are we going to learn? What's going to happen? Like, what's the forecast? Are we like, is it going to be even more asset price inflation in the stock market? Is it going to be, I don't know what to imagine.
Just quickly on that, I mean, I've always been struck by how the so-called rate moderation is often described as if it didn't have any inflation, or inflation was low. Seems to me that there's a period of hyperinflation. It was hyperinflation in the asset markets rather than inclusive conservative markets. I've never understood why we artificially separate between those two things. Indeed, even if you look at the statutory language that provides the Fed with this mandate, the reference is to price stability, not to the CPI, right? And so that, to me, highlights once again the sense in which distribution is at the core of everything. Distribution is fundamental. I don't think you'll find asset price inflation in the asset, very few assets that those below the top of the distribution own. But I suspect you'll see continued lots of, you know, even asset price hyperinflation in those asset markets that are primarily populated by those who are at the top of the distribution.
Just a quick comment. One of my favorite charts that I show, that I reference a lot, is a chart of debt as a percentage of GDP. No, sorry, deficit as a percentage of GDP versus the unemployment rate. And historically, it's very clear that the two lines go together, and it makes sense because the economy improves, the deficit shrinks. And so people point out it's kind of unusual now that we see the unemployment rate continue that falling, but the deficit is expanding, and that is interesting, and partly due to the tax cuts. But the two lines have actually been separating since 2013. So going back a few years already, there's already sort of a structural break in the relationship between the size of the deficit as a percentage of GDP versus what's happening cyclically in the economy. So there was the previous questioner who pointed out, you know, the growing entitlements, that's going to be the sort of permanent large-scale government disabling and greater profits for the private sector, potentially greater savings. We may be seeing that, and while, you know, you mentioned that there's sort of this in real-time experiment with Trump, we might be seeing trends that precede the tax cuts a little bit that are just sort of part of the nature of the changing economy.
I'm not going to forecast market moves, so, you know, if I could do that, you know, that would benefit from Korea. I'd probably be retired by now. But I just come up, you just mentioned Joel. I just want to get one of my back pairs out on the table. And everybody does this, including my former employer, S&P. I'm talking about, you know, debt to GDP ratios as percentages. So Japan came up, for example, gross debt is something like 240%, net debt is 150%. But that's not the right unit, because when you frame things in terms of 100%, 150%, it has this sort of scare tactic. Oh my God, we've blown through 100%, this must be terrible. Of course, the unit is number of years of GDP. So it's debt is, of course, the dollar per, say, is a stock, and then GDP is a flow, so it's flow of dollars per time period. So the unit is number of years. So Japan's 140% GDP, 140% of GDP, is really saying if the Japanese government were to have to repay all its debt now, it would take 1.4 years of GDP to do it. But of course, the government doesn't have to, it has an infinite horizon. So actually now, wow, how long is the Japanese government or the US government going to last? You know, again, conventional economists will say, well, the government has an infinite horizon. So 1 or 2 years or 3 years, frankly speaking, is trivial in that context.
I think we could all agree debt to GDP is a nonsense ratio that gets you no exciting
thing.
How do you get around, I guess my question, the stupid question is, how do you get around the fiduciary responsibility that are in corporate charters, like saying we have to maximize profit? How do you square that view?
Yeah, so the short end is a great question. It's not silly at all. But my answer might belie that claim. And because the short answer is there is no such fiduciary view, and there's nothing to that effect in any corporate charter. That's sort of a myth. Rowan's and my dear colleague and staff devoted most of her career to debunking that myth, which was first propagated at least conspicuously by Milton Friedman. Now, it's true that there's a lot of short-term profit maximization that sort of functions as a kind of de facto norm or a kind of de facto sort of guiding principle for many corporate fiduciaries. I think it's basically because it's sort of an easy benchmark, right? You can sort of, you've got a nice simple metric to point to and say, well, look, we must be doing a good job and share prices are doing well. But the fact remains that it's not a doctrine of corporate law and it's not contractually written into most corporate charters that the be-all and end-all of the corporate executive's duty is to maximize profits or share, I should say, about share price.
Okay, another stupid question is, does anyone know how in what they might do, as the co-chairs of that, in terms of what their strategy is? Because Powell, being a corporate guy, can only publish a lot of information. And then with Clara, basically an academic in some of the life, but he also ended up as info. But at the same time, these are the two guys that are controlling the Fed.
I can tell you the market take on Powell. I don't know him personally, but I know people who know him. I don't know if my second academic is helpful, but the take that I can get from everybody in the market, so everybody who knows him, is that he's a kind of Jack Yellen clone, a sort of a slightly, you know, sort of inferior Yellen, by which I mean he wants to be a kind of Yellen. His outlook is like Yellen's, but he doesn't have quite the brilliance that she had. But you don't have to be that brilliant to do what she did. She had brilliance in excess of what was required in my second job. Powell is maybe doesn't have brilliance in excess of what's required for job, but it's the same degree, apparently has the same outlook. I'm told that, as you know, basically looks at things the same way, which is one reason a whole bunch of us, when Trump announced Powell as his pick, we heaved a huge sigh of relief. I literally did think it was going to be Jared Kushner or Ivanka. I mean, but Caligula can appoint a horse to the Roman Senate, and the Supreme Court can appoint George W. Bush to the White House, and then, I don't know, the Electoral College can put, you know, this orange creature in the White House. I mean, there's no telling what might happen to the Fed. I think we kind of dodged a bullet. He's not great, but this is about the least horrible of the appointments that he's made. He and Andrew Quarles, the enforcement director over at the, I'm sorry, the enforcement guy on the Fed board.
It's also interesting to see the way the traders talk about Powell versus Yellen, because, like you said, they are basically very, very similar in outlook. But the traders, when they talk about him, are almost a little scared because they're like, oh, he's a markets guy, which means, like, oh, he's not going to be scared when you talk about the market trying to call out the Fed. So that, I mean, the fact that the bond market itself might be more intimidated right now might be a good thing also. I have some questions about why it wasn't more intimidated by Janet Yellen, but those are for different people.
Can I also point out that the Modern Money Network actually did a seminar where Richard Clarida was there with Jamie Galbraith and Matthias Venego of the Future of Central Banking about 2014. The video is up online, but it was a very interesting chance to have him interact with the sort of MMT consistent views. I think maybe Marshall Harlock was there as well.
Thank you.
Two more questions and then we'll close up.
This is a bond of treaty question. You know, a couple of people referred earlier to the fact that many people in the financial area are still believers in their own funds doctrine. Now, does this provide, some kind of opportunity for bond trading? Because I could wind up with interest rates being bid up over what they really would normally be, and then come a recession and drop, substantially. Kind of getting to the issue here that was raised about, bonds at 6%, these long bonds at 6%, that's a real buy signal. So, do you think that this is something that, is this misunderstanding of vulnerable funds, is this going to increase bond prices, which is then to give an opportunity, an additional opportunity for profit on selling bonds?
So I'll just speak to, sometimes, yes, there can be clear opportunities if you believe in or misbehaved on things like that. But the reality is that there's a lot of different buyers and sellers that are placing a bond curve, and they're expressing views that they have nothing to do with where they think, you know, fair value of return is. They can be doing it for things like regulatory reasons, for solvency reasons, right? So the intersection of a lot of those points, a lot of people like to think, are some type of bond market view. But sometimes it's just where a bunch of buyers and sellers who have very different motivations have come together. In it, somewhere, is a belief, right? And parsing that out is the very imperfect like part of investing in the bond market. So, and I don't think I've ever met anyone who's done that perfectly or has bad bond.
I know that everyone here basically makes their living measuring the economy in some way. But the ways that you are measuring the economy, the bond market, the equities market, Wall Street in general, none of which really takes into consideration what's going on in small business, what's going on Main Street. And Main Street, if anybody had bothered to ask Main Street, they could have told you in 2006 that 2008 was coming. You know, and not the reasons, they probably wouldn't have known what was going to blow it up, but they knew something was wrong. And my question is, do you look toward Main Street in any way? If so, what is that way? And if you aren't looking that direction, should we be measuring that in some way? Should there be some, magical number that we don't have right now?
So I'll just say a quick thing about that. I mean, that question is a wonderful question, and it's sort of at the core of most of the work I'm doing right now. So just a sort of responsive and sort of an advertisement of stuff to come. I think that I'm amazed at how little attention is paid to a sort of a distinction that's fundamental to everything that we talk about when we talk about financial markets. And it's unbelievably important, and we never seem to talk about it, but why it's important. And that is the distinction between primary markets and secondary markets. Primary markets are just that's money that goes into expanding actual productive capacity and actual production. Secondary market is always basically just trading stuff that's already out there, that's already an issue. And in fact, I've actually been developing an index in recent years that I'm almost finished with. It's been calling the financialization index, which essentially measures secondary market trading volume as a numerator and then primary market capitalization as a denominator. And one nice way to put a number on the street, which we've been analyzed over the years, is just by watching the performance of that fraction over time. Now, there's a standard story that's always told about why the secondary markets are important. Of course, it's the liquidity story, and the primary markets are much better capitalized when you have liquidity. But we've long since, I think, passed the point of diminishing returns on liquidity, and so we actually get much more discounted, I think, the secondary markets. That we have actually functionality and usefulness that comes from this market. And your question, in a way, highlights precisely what one of those problems is, right? We tend to fixate on all of these measures, which are all secondary market measures, almost all of them. And those are not measures of anything that really matters when it comes to real productive capacity, real productive activity, and hence real employment and actual use of the taking up of slack in the economy, actual use of the economy's capacity. So one of my sort of longer-term academic projects, but it also dovetails with my market involvement because I'm working with some market practitioners, some colleagues in the markets in developing the index, is precisely to try to change the focal point and thereby change the conversation. And the way you change the focal point is you come up with something that you attach a number to because everybody just looks at numbers. And the problem is we've attached the numbers to the wrong focal points. And that's what I think is the real significance of your question, or at least the broader significance of it. So I'm quite grateful to you for raising it.
Yeah, I don't think that, if you looked at, market participants, it's a broad category. Pretty much, they look at everything. And so that they are looking at Main Street and the small business sentiment indicators and everything else. But I do think, and now, of course, even central banks are into sort of like real market, real-time monitoring of internet sales and then sort of using big data and new technologies and scan, all these sort of Internet of Things devices. So, if you can measure it, and if it gives you some kind of signal about where things are going, people will get there. But I do think that the whole system has become, this financialization kind of issue is, I think, a really big one. I'm not sure in the MMT community how that issue is sort of being looked at and thought of. But I often point out, with just going back to a standard monetary policy framework, that monetary policy works through a three-stage process: set monetary policy, Jim Powell and a bunch of guys and gals in the FOMC. That then is transmitted, monetary policy is transmitted through the financial system, through the financialization world. And then the third leg is, of course, well, okay, that financial conditions are eased or tight, whatever. And then the question is, how does the real economy respond to that? In some sense, what is Main Street doing? But the whole system has become so self-referential that it's almost as if the real economy, the Main Street, is sort of not there. It's all in those first two stages. But again, I think the financialization part of it is really, really interesting, because when you think about monetary policy, the financial markets and the central banks are engaged in a joint process of transmitting monetary policy. But the incentives of the financial community are very, very different. They want to basically make money, and they make a lot of money by sort of figuring out what central banks are going to do. The central banks are acting through them. So if you think of principal agent theory, the financial markets are the agents of the principals of central banks. And sort of, so it's sort of, I call it in one of my papers, an unwhole alliance, which it sort of is. But it's very easy to fall back on the canal of basic observations. Like, well, at the end of the day, this is all in the service of Main Street and the real world. That's why we need to do all this stuff. There's a little bit of a sleight of hand use there.
You know, with that, I think we got to wrap it up. So thank you to the. Thank you very much. We'll take 5 minutes. We'll start here about 3:25. Please get in here before that, so we can start on the 3:25.